From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present the second half of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with intelligent design theorist Stephen Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life, and The Case for Intelligent Design. Now, let's join Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Meyer in their conversation.
So many people have heard of Francis Collins, The Language of God. It has become very, very popular. It's widely recognized as having been able to bridge the chasm between the biblical worldview and the evolutionary dogma. But it's problematic, and you're alluding to this. It's problematic not only from a biblical perspective, but it's problematic from a scientific perspective. A huge body of scientific evidence challenges the creative power of the mutation selection mechanism. And again, I call that, you know, buying high and selling low.
Yeah, it's very good. One of my colleagues, Jay Richards, another evangelical Catholic, by the way, he talks about theologians making virtue of necessity. And very often what you have is a theologian will say, well, you know, this is actually, there's a good theological reason for getting rid of the idea of the soul, or a good theological reason for adopting Darwinism. And then they come up with some tortured kind of rationalization. But he said what they're doing is making virtue, theological virtue, of the sociological necessity of accepting Darwinism as a condition of acceptance in the culture. And we're trying to say no longer necessary. It wasn't a good strategy before. It's worse now, because even leading mainstream evolutionary biologists are saying we need a new theory. Many of my colleagues and I attended the Royal Society meeting in November of 2016. We write a bit about it in the Theistic Evolution book, and pointed out that the meeting was called by leading evolutionary theorists who wanted to evaluate the current status of neo-Darwinism in a critical and skeptical way, because most of them who called the meeting were critical and skeptical, and secondly, to explore what other evolutionary mechanisms might be in play that could either replace or supplement the inadequate mechanism of mutation and selection. At the beginning of the conference, the first talk was by a prominent Austrian evolutionary biologist, Gerd Müller, who outlined the explanatory deficits of the neo-Darwinian mechanism and neo-Darwinian theory. His talk could have been taken right out of Darwin's Doubt. He talked about the problem of phenotypic, that is body-level, visible complexity in organisms. He talked about the problem of anatomical novelty. Where do you get all these new complex structures? And he talked about the abrupt appearance of fossil forms in the geological record. None of these problems, he thought, had been solved. The problem of the origin of biological form, he lists with a co-author in another book, is an unsolved problem. At the end of the conference, as they explored these different other possible evolutionary mechanisms, one of the people who was a prime mover in a group called the Altenburg 16, which are evolutionary biologists critical of neo-Darwinism, and who was involved in putting together the conference, said that unfortunately the conference was characterized by a lack of momentousness. This is Susan Mazur. And so, in other words, the conference defined the problems with neo-Darwinism effectively at the beginning, but at the end, even the proponents had to realize that they hadn't solved those problems. So this is a very strange time for the big push in the Christian world to get Christians and Christian leaders to effectively baptize neo-Darwinism or some other form of evolutionary thinking when there's such a crisis in the field. Science does not impel us towards that compromise. We're not under an obligation to synthesize these two systems of thought. People need to stick to their theological guns.
And there's a reason why, too. I mean, I think we have to pan back and look at the fact that ideas have consequences. You think about the absolute chaos in the culture today as a result of the sexual revolution. The concept of a creator God is said to interfere with our sexual mores. Well, we've rationalized God out of existence, and now we have, I mean, things that honestly I never ever expected to see in my lifetime, where now gender is not determined by biology, it's determined by your feelings.
Well, let me talk about another cultural consequence of this. It's, I think, very poignant and very, very of great personal concern to me. We have an epidemic of suicide among young people in this country. And just in our local sphere of personal associations, we have known a number of young people who have made that just really tragic choice, or known families where that have been afflicted by that. And very oftentimes, when you get to the bottom of what's going on, yes, the psychologist will call it depression, or maybe it's anxiety and depression, or it's something, but there's often a metaphysical element to it. I myself went through this as a 14, 15, 16-year-old, where I had the very deep questions. I didn't know they were philosophical questions. I didn't know they were metaphysical questions, but they bothered me, and I couldn't answer them, and that made me think something was wrong with me. And I later, after my own conversion, I began to read the Bible on my own in my late teen years, and I found that many of the questions that I was asking about the meaning of life, what's anything going to matter in 100 years, what is time, is there anything that's unchanging, how do we know things? I had these questions I couldn't answer. They bothered me, and it put me into a kind of a downward spiral, and it was the Bible that pulled me out of it. And I didn't have one of those conversion experiences where suddenly I felt great joy, but I felt normal for the first time because I had structure to my thinking. I had a framework for answering questions that previously I couldn't answer. And we had a call from a bereaved father soon after the release of the film Expelled. And his son, a young man named Jesse Kilgore, had committed suicide. And his story was very, very compelling. And the father said, if he had only seen your film, I know he would have known there were answers to his questions. And Jesse had been in the military. He was a military chaplain. He got out, went back to school, was in a university taking biology. He had an aggressive new atheist professor who was proselytizing the students in service of the new atheist creed. He challenged Jesse to read one of the big new atheist books. Jesse did. It really shook him. He was, from the margin notes they found in the book after his death, he was taking this very seriously. He couldn't answer the questions. First, he lost his faith, and then he lost his hope. And whereas these professors will talk about how human beings are pollution or how life has no meaning and revel in that, young people are looking for answers to those deep questions. And when they're told that science undermines the possibility of answers, or that it gives them an essentially nihilistic answer, that there is no meaning, that all we have is mindless particles in motion, and when we die, we rot, and that's all there is, it raises that great existential question, which is, why continue to live? And so I think this epidemic of teen suicide, or the suicide of young people even into the early 20s, is something that has a metaphysical root. It's a consequence of that that depressing scientific materialistic worldview, which very easily transitions from scientific materialism to another worldview called nihilism. And so it's just one of many cultural implications of this way of thinking. It's not an argument that scientific materialism is wrong. I think you have to prosecute that argument on the basis of the evidence. But these ideas do have consequences. And if they are wrong, by all means, we need to oppose them. I love the passage from 2 Corinthians that says, we come against every argument and pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And I personally, as a Christian involved in this work, am concerned to help restore the knowledge of God in the culture.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I'm just reading a book by Paul Chamberlain, Why People Stop Believing. And one of the things he points out at the introduction of that book is how many people who are academics have left the Christian faith. And oftentimes when you read them for all the wrong reasons, for example, you have Bart Ehrman, who's made a cottage industry out of writing books that he is very proud to say have caused all of the Christians that come through his classes, and he's pretty universal on that, to leave the Christian faith. But when you read his arguments or his objections, they seem rather easy to deal with. But
They're phenomenally weak.
But there are so many people like this, and there's a sense in which if someone writes a book against Islam as a former Muslim, that person has a tremendous amount of credibility and weight. And it seems to me that the same thing is true when someone has been in the inside of Christianity, as it were, as an academic, and now they're writing works to debunk the Christian faith. That seems to have tremendous weight for so many people who are looking, obviously, in many cases, for an excuse to rid themselves of any objective reference to truth.
Sure. That works the other way, too, though. We have a lot of scientists who've been on the inside with Darwinian materialism who are moving the other direction. So I think that is a hopeful thing for the future. And there are also a lot of good archaeologists who will defend the historicity of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. So I don't think people should let Bart Ehrman be the last word on those issues either. I did a series on the scientific evidence for intelligent design and extending that further to look at the case for God, but also on the archaeological evidences for the reliability of the Bible. It's called True You. Young archaeologists who work closely with me on the research on that. Bart Ehrman gets up his nose because he, as you were saying, thinks the arguments are very weak and they're not apprised of all the wonderful archaeological corroboration there is for the Bible from Abraham all the way through Jesus. So that's another topic we could discuss, but it underscores, I think, a bigger issue, which is the need for an intellectual defense of the Christian faith in a time when so many academics just reflexively want to say it has no credibility. To me, it's very odd because in many ways, there is more evidence now than there has ever been, and it's very compelling.
Yeah, well said. I want to get back to this whole idea of concepts having consequences. You want to address the racist implications of the evolutionary model? We're living in a state of cognitive dissonance, it seems to me. You have cultural elites who are rightly lauding equality, the equality of men and women. They're rightly censuring the notion that there are superior and inferior races, and yet the evolutionary dogma, by its very nature, seems to me to necessitate inequality.
Well, certainly in the 19th century, there were many of the leading evolutionary biologists who thought that the gradation of forms extended through the different racial groups of humans, and that there were higher and lower races corresponding to more or less evolved or more or less advanced in the evolutionary, I hate to use the word progression because evolution isn't supposed to say anything about progression, but somehow that idea was incorporated into this. So there was a lot of scientific racism that came out of the 19th century. It spawned the eugenics movement. My colleague John West has written very extensively and persuasively on this, and he has an award-winning new film out about the role of Darwinism and scientific racism around the turn of the 19th to 20th century, in a very sad case of a young African man, Odabenga, who was actually displayed in a New York zoo in the first decades, I think it was the 1906, 08, in that time frame. So there is an untold story of the racism that Darwinian evolution spawned. A lot of evolutionary biologists today would, of course, want to reject that and say that it's not inherent to the theory. It's something you could debate, but the history of this is, I think, indubitable.
And you have this whole idea of, in the modern world, the elimination of unfit genes. So Iceland, for example, you have Down syndrome baby abortions. You have the pre-implantation of genetic diagnosis technology. And with that, the idea is if we can eliminate the unfit genes, then the fit genes can multiply more rapidly.
It's a form of positive eugenics. I think you're right. And you also, negative eugenics is you exterminate people with genetic defects. Obviously, the Nazis were big into that, but there was a fair amount of that going on in the United States, not through extermination, but through sterilization. And those practices only stopped after the death camps were revealed by General Patton. So we have a very unsavory history of that in the United States up to the end of World War II. And some of that is coming back with this sex selection abortions, various things that have an echo of that. I think the whole issue of abortion versus the sanctity of life is something else that reflects that underlying worldview issue of, and materialism, I think, leads naturally to the presumption that a fetus in the womb is just a collection of tissue or a lump of cells. Abortion is justified very often on a very materialistic sort of rationale. And so it's another one of the consequences of Darwinism, the creation story, materialism is the worldview built atop that. But those Darwinian materialistic assumptions do play out into a number of ways, into the thinking that dominates our culture. And that's why our center is called the Center for Science and Culture, and we mean to renew both with better ideas.
What's really interesting in the abortion debate today is that the argument is shifting. Now there's little gravitas in saying that this is not a human being. There's too much evidence that the developing embryo is a human being. So now the argument shifts to whether or not that being is a person that has worth or weight or deserves to live.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. The ultrasound technology that has exposed actually the cognitive abilities of the fetus very early on, the response of fetal pain to the abortion procedure, I think has moved a lot of people to recognize, no, we're dealing with a human in development that is aware. As I recall, the neurological evidence shows that the fetus is not responding just reflexively to pain stimuli, but actually in an aversive way that shows coordinated motor movements.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Intelligent design, the idea that an intelligent cause rather than an undirected process best explains key features of life and the universe, continues to ignite controversy around the world. In Signature in the Cell, Stephen Meyer shows that digital code embedded in DNA points to a designing intelligence and helps unravel a mystery that Charles Darwin did not address. How did life begin? For details on how you can support the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute and receive your copy of Signature in the Cell, simply call 888-7000-CRI. 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Hank Hanegraaff and Stephen Meyer will be back right after the break. A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. A major reason mindfulness has been successfully mainstreamed is that we are so overstimulated and chronically busy. Because mindfulness has entrenched itself in American culture, Christians need to investigate it thoroughly in order to determine whether it is friend or foe. Other topics include the Jesus of Mormonism, the philosophy of atheist Bertrand Russell, how does the human soul come into existence, the story of Morgan Freeman, not God, is it abusive to teach children about hell, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
From the outside, Houston preacher Joel Osteen is charming, attractive, and his teaching, well, it makes you feel good. But the truth is, Osteen preaches a seductive and highly dangerous form of Christianity that's leading millions of people astray. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. And it's why you must get your own copy today. You must be able to defend yourself with truth about what Joel Osteen really teaches. And this important resource arms you with everything you need to do so. Please call today and request your copy of The Osteenification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI.
or go online to equip.org. Welcome back to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. On today's special edition, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with intelligent design theorist Dr. Stephen Meyer. Let's rejoin Hank and Dr. Meyer in their conversation.
The ultrasound technology that has exposed actually the cognitive abilities of the fetus very early on, the response of fetal pain to the abortion procedure, I think has moved a lot of people to recognize, no, we're dealing with a human in development that is aware. As I recall, the neurological evidence shows that the fetus is not responding just reflexively to pain stimuli, but actually in an aversive way that shows coordinated motor movements and things. So that, I think, has moved a lot of people away from support for abortion, that technology. And it's, but anyway, we're maybe getting a lot off topic for me, but I did write about that a bit in the 90s, and I think the scientific evidence of personhood is pretty strong.
Well, let's get back on topic. I want to get you to react to some of my favorite quotes, not favorite in a positive way, but Richard Dawkins, for example, said, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose."
Right. I actually really appreciate Dawkins because of the clarity with which he defines essential issues. He's always on the wrong side by my lights, and he would say the same of me, I'm sure. But that's the key issue in biology. Is biology the result of merely apparent design? Does it manifest the illusion of design? Or does that appearance of design indicate the actual activity of a designing intelligence in the origin and history of life? Dawkins says it's merely apparent. That is the Darwinian answer, going back to Darwin himself. And that's why our theory was named the theory of intelligent design. We were wanting to contrast our view with the view of the Darwinians, who say that design is only apparent. And it's also one of the reasons we haven't gotten big into fighting about the age of the Earth, because we think that that is really the key issue, design or no design, design or merely the illusion of design. So we appreciate Dawkins for framing that issue so clearly.
And Ernst Mayr, he said, "The real core of Darwinism is the theory of natural selection. This theory is so important for the Darwinian because it permits the explanation of adaptation, the design of the natural theologian by natural means instead of by divine intervention."
Right. It's the same issue. Is the adaptation was the appearance of design that most struck 19th century biologists. Birds live in the air, they have wings, they make nests. Fish live underwater, they have gills and swim bladders. And so every organism seemed to be fitted to the environment in which it lived. And Darwin came along and explained at least the way in which organisms can adapt in a minor way to their environment. And therefore, he thought he'd explained adaptation as the result of the unguided, undirected process of natural selection. I like to use the example of woolly sheep in the far north of Scotland, and how if you breed just for woolly sheep, if you just choose the wooliest generation after generation, you're going to get a woollier breed in that cold climate. Darwin came along and said, in effect, well, what if you have a series of very cold winters, such that only the wooliest survive to breed? Won't you get the same outcome? And that idea works very well for the small-scale variations and adaptation on a small scale. What biologists are finding today, however, is it doesn't explain the origin of things like sheep or mammals or animal forms in the first place. So it explains the adaptive survival, but not the arrival of the fittest. And so the appearance of design that struck the 19th century biologists, at least things like sheep getting woolier and finches getting slightly bigger or smaller beaks, Darwinism explains well. It does not explain those major origin events. It doesn't explain the information, perhaps the most striking appearance of design in biology, that's necessary to build new animal forms. So again, Mayr frames the issue beautifully, but I think what we've learned since the Darwin centennial in 1859, when he was a big player, or since Darwin himself, or even since Dawkins wrote the book Blind Watchmaker in 86, has strongly pushed the case for real design, not just apparent design.
To that point, Francis Crick said that biologists have to constantly keep in mind that what they're seeing was not designed, but rather evolved.
Yeah, it's the same concept that life looks designed, but it's not really designed because an unguided, undirected process produced the appearance without itself being designed or guided in any way. And we have taken the opposite view. Things look designed because they really were designed. Living organisms have specific appearances of design, like digital code or like functionally integrated circuitry or nanotechnology that does actually bear all the hallmarks of a design system and which has not been explained by the undirected, unguided designer substitute mechanism of natural selection. So again, beautiful setting up of the binary choice on the central issue. And that Crick quote is especially, I think, instructive because with his quote, you see that the appearance of design is very strong, that you have to remind yourself, you've got to talk yourself out of the evidence of design. And I think we need to get back to the phenomena and say, well, maybe they're telling us something and take them more seriously, especially since we know that the designer substitute mechanism has really not done a good job of explaining the complexity of life, which is the most striking appearance of design.
Here's one more. This is by UC Berkeley professor of psychology, Allison Gupnik, and she says this, by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them, even children brought up as atheists. And thus she advocates for the pedagogical goal to teach young children evolution before the wrong view is too firmly in place.
It's a form of materialistic re-education. They used to do that in the Soviet Union with respect to the Marxist form of materialism. It also speaks, I think, to what the philosopher Alvin Plantinga calls the innate noetic capabilities of human beings, and that our minds, when they're properly functioning, do perceive that design, and we're meant to do so.
The myth of Darwin's Tree of Life, for the average person listening in, I think this is something that ought to be underscored over and over again. It's been uprooted, and yet you find it being explicated and pictured. It's an icon that seems to never die.
Right. Increasingly, both aspects of Darwinian evolution are being questioned. Creative power of the mechanism, of the mutation selection mechanism, has been questioned for quite a long time now. One of the leading scientists at the Royal Society meeting said that criticism of neo-Darwinism has become so early 90s. It's passé. But increasingly, the other part of Darwinian theory, the pattern, the historical pattern, not the process, the theory of universal common descent is being questioned. Our colleague Paul Nelson is playing a big role in that. One of the huge discoveries of contemporary genomics is the discovery of what are called orphan genes. These are genes with no known sequence similarity or homology to other genes. Now, on a Darwinian view, every gene should have evolved from some other gene by a very small incremental accumulation of mutational change. And so you should see a high degree of sequence similarity between every gene and some other gene somewhere in the biological world across the phylogenetic categories. And in fact, a growing number of these orphan genes are being found in across the taxonomic categories. It's a very big new area of study in biology. They shouldn't exist on a Darwinian model. They speak to the discontinuity of groups, not to the continuous morphing of one group into another as depicted by the Tree of Life. So just one of many evidences, I think, against common descent. Another was beautifully explicated yesterday in our summer seminar by Gunter Beckley, who was talking about not just the Cambrian explosion, but 17 or 18 other major fossil discontinuities, other major fossil radiations. The first sea reptiles, the first fishes, the first birds. You just go right through the fossil record and the different types of organisms. They appear very abruptly. So in both the genomic and the paleontological record or data, we have discontinuity, not continuity, both of which are speaking against the Darwinian Tree of Life view of the history of life.
You think about Darwinian views. Darwin speculated that bears might well evolve into whales. And then I would say, in stark contrast, you have contemporary Darwinists, neo-Darwinists, who hold that hippo-like animals evolved into whales. I mean, it doesn't seem like you've progressed a whole lot.
Well, right, and the evidence there is, I think, very weak. There's a superficial kind of reconstruction of fossils that you can align if you want to, but the characters that define the distinctive features of aquatic mammals occur very abruptly in that sequence in a 1 to 3 million year window. And there's a further problem with the whale sequence, which is called the waiting times problem. My colleague Richard Sternberg will be presenting on that tomorrow to our, sorry to keep referencing our context this week, but we got all these bright young scientists here. And the Darwinian mechanism, there's a Darwinian math, it's called population genetics, and it allows you to calculate the amount of evolutionary change you would expect to occur in a given amount of time if you know certain factors like the size of the population and the generation times and the mutation rate. And Sternberg has calculated that to get just two coordinated mutations in this transition from land-dwelling mammals, hippo-like ancestors, to the basilosaurs and the other aquatic first whales, you would need something like 43 million years for just two coordinated mutations, and yet you have hundreds of anatomical innovations that take place between the two types of organisms. It's not easy to put a land-dwelling mammal and get it to live and reproduce underwater. And Sternberg goes through all the details, and the transition is actually really implausible from a Darwinian point of view.
What does science today say about the plausibility of a historical Adam and Eve?
We have a research project on that. It's not specifically around the biblical concept of Adam and Eve, but could human beings have originated from a two-parent breeding pair? And there is actually a section in the Theistic Evolution book on this current research that's being done about this genomically. And until recently, there was a study by Francisco Ayala that people took as sort of gospel. A lot of theologians were told that science had settled the issue, that there was humans at best might have emerged from a group of 10,000 hominids or something. Actually, very recently been established by a research team that we've been supporting and conceded by members of the BioLogos Foundation, who are theistic evolutionists, that the genomics is perfectly consistent with a two-parent origin for anatomically modern humans. That's us. There's debates about how long ago that would have taken place, but the genomics is consistent with that model. And there'll be a lot more coming out on that. That's an active area of research that some of our genomics and genetics people are working on. Ann Gager is the key scientist working on that, molecular biologist. And much of that research is in the Theistic Evolution book for people who want to read more on it.
And again, that book available, you can find it on the web at equip.org. One major question I wanted to ask you, and that is whether or not you think it's true, obviously this is a bit rhetorical, that there is a 98% similarity between human DNA and
chimp DNA.
Oh
my goodness, don't even get me started on this. This is the worst science in the world. Yeah, so many things to say. The first, there is a high degree of sequence similarity of many proteins of humans and chimps. The sequence similarity will probably be settling in the low 90s. Right now, I think the best estimate is about 95%, not 98%. But there are multiple layers of fallacy in this. The first is that DNA is not all of what it takes to build an animal form. DNA builds the proteins, and proteins do not an animal make.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with intelligent design theorist Dr. Stephen Meyer in just a few moments. Charles Darwin knew that there was a significant event in the history of life that his theory did not explain. In what is known today as the Cambrian Explosion, 530 million years ago, many animals suddenly appeared in the fossil record without apparent ancestors in earlier layers of rock. In Darwin's Doubt, Stephen Meyer tells the story of the mystery surrounding this explosion of animal life. Dr. Meyer argues that the theory of intelligent design, which holds that certain features and patterns of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, not an undirected process such as natural selection, is ultimately the best explanation for the origin of the Cambrian animals. For details on how you can support the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute and receive your copy of Darwin's Doubt, call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of Hank Hanegraaff's interview with Dr. Stephen Meyer on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, Osteenification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master. Not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Osteenification of American Christianity. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. It is important to understand the sources of our modern distaste for the teaching of the doctrine of hell, for they are part of the strongholds characteristic of our times. By critically exploring these sources, we can best instruct children in the essential biblical doctrine of hell and avoid an actual abuse of greater severity, which would be their being unaware of its reality. Other topics include Called to be Mere Ambassadors, The Story of God with Morgan Freeman, The Jesus of Mormonism, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. You've tuned in to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Pastor Martin Niemöller spent the last 7 years of Nazi rule in concentration camps. Reflecting on the camps where millions would die, Niemöller said, "First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionist, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." To ensure that your voice is heard and that someone is speaking for you, become a member today of CRI's support team. Simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. Let's rejoin Hank's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer.
One major question I want to ask you, and that is whether or not you think it's true, obviously this is a bit rhetorical, that there is a 98% similarity between human DNA and
chimp
DNA. Oh my
goodness, don't even get me started on this. This is the worst science in the world. Yeah, so many things to say. The first, there is a high degree of sequence similarity of many proteins of humans and chimps. The sequence similarity will probably be settling in the low 90s. Right now, I think the best estimate is about 95%, not 98%. But there are multiple layers of fallacy in this. The first is that DNA is not all of what it takes to build an animal form. DNA builds the proteins, and proteins do not an animal make. And so we have low-level informational modules that are quite similar to the low-level informational modules that are in chimps and other animals. In fact, we have high degree of sequence similarity, a lot of different things. Our sequence similarity is closer to chimps, that's true, than others. But the 95% similarity is not at all impressive to computer programmers because they also use informational modules and they reuse them in lots of different ways. And the low-level code gets reused in very different applications. And so the difference that makes a difference is often a very small amount of code. So that's one thing to point out, because the difference that makes a difference is often the higher level codes that's telling the lower level modules how to be arranged. And what we now know about the junk DNA is that the non-coding regions of the DNA are functioning. They're not the residuum of a long trial and error process of mutation and selection. They are functional, the non-coding regions, and they are functioning to regulate the timing and expression of the coding modules, the parts of the DNA that build for proteins. So we have a lot of things we're learning about how small bits of code can make a big difference, or about how regulatory code can coordinate the use of the parts of the code that get compared. Like our hemoglobin molecules that capture oxygen in the bloodstream are highly similar to those of monkeys. I think they may be 100% similar. They do the exact same job. But when such proteins get turned on and turned off is an entirely different matter. So the regulatory DNA is very different between chimps and humans. And that makes a big difference. In addition, we have what's called epigenetic or ontogenetic information that's necessary for body plan construction that is not the same and is not even measured, because we don't have a good way of measuring that yet between chimps and humans. In addition, there's a paper that's just come out or coming out soon in our top biology journal, Biocomplexity, by a young computer scientist who's showing that the way in which computer scientists use and reuse modules of code, what in the computer science is called a dependency graph, and the dependency graph model does a much better job of explaining both the similarities and the differences in code that we find in chimps and humans than a standard Darwinian tree model. So looking at code from a computer science point of view gives a much better description and explanation of the patterns we see in the code, which is a design-based way of looking at things rather than the, well, simple similarity points to common ancestry argument. Sorry for such a long answer. I told you not to get me going.
I wanted to get you going on that, actually. But here's one other thing I was just thinking about, and that is something that Thomas Nagel said. He's a noted atheist philosopher, of course. He said that defenders of intelligent design deserve our gratitude. His quote goes on to say that even though writers like Michael Behe and Stephen Meyer are motivated at least in part by their religious beliefs, the empirical arguments they offer against the likelihood that the origin of life and its evolutionary history can be fully explained by physics and chemistry are of great interest in themselves. Another skeptic, David Berlinski, has brought out these problems vividly without reference to the design inference, even if one is not drawn to the alternative of an explanation by the actions of a designer. The problems that these iconoclasts pose for the orthodox scientific consensus must be taken seriously. They do not deserve the scorn with which they are commonly met. It is manifestly unfair. How cool is that?
Yeah, it was very cool. I mean, Nagel, he's an eminence in the American Academy and leading philosopher of science, NYU. He's been very clear in his own about his own worldview. I had a wonderful lunch with him in New York, and he said that he simply doesn't want the universe to be the kind of place in which there is a person such as God. He's temperamentally inclined towards atheism, but he's seen the force of the arguments that we've made. He wrote his own book, Mind and Cosmos, how the neo-Darwinian materialist explanation of reality is almost certainly false, I think was the subtitle. I'm indebted to him because he recommended my book for commendation with the Times Literary Supplement, and then continued to defend his choice in a very heated exchange of letters in that journal after it was published. I thought he'd want nothing more to do with the issue, and then 2 years later he came out with his own book. So he's a very interesting figure. Berlinski is, full disclosure, one of my closest friends. I love the guy. He's just a very, very authentic man and a deep, deep intellect. And he is a fellow of the Center for Science and Culture and the editor of a fascinating new journal called Inference that maybe your readers would be interested in. And it's an international review of science. It's kind of like the New York Times review of books for science. And he's got all kinds of interesting people across the spectrum writing and doing what you indicated needed to be done earlier, which is not take the authority of the scientists at face value, but critically evaluate lots of different ideas in science. And so he's, I think, one of the great intellectuals of our modern culture, and tremendous respect for David.
And he's eminently quotable.
Very quotable. Yeah. Oh, what a wordsmith. You know, he's a great writer.
I remember him saying that Darwin's theory of evolution was the last of the great 19th century mystery religions. And he said, as we speak, it is now following Freudianism and Marxism into the nether regions. I'm quite sure that Freud, Marx, and Darwin are commiserating one with another in the dark dungeon where discarded gods gather. That's one that you could not only hear, but memorize quite quickly.
Yeah, I know him very well, but I had not heard that quote. It's his business card is a trip, because he's a mathematician and a philosopher by training, but he's an extraordinary writer. I think he's published 17 books, and he lists all of the different types of writing that he is willing to be paid to do, including calling down imprecations on one's enemies and funeral perorations. And anyway, he's very funny, as well as a deep and authentic person. I love him very much. He's a great friend.
Well, I'm jealous. I don't know him personally, but I think it'd be a blast too. One last thing, we end with this, and we've sort of alluded to this, but the insiders in the evolutionary community, they're fairly aware of their theory's desperate condition, but the general public, I think, is as yet in the dark. And that's where, well, Christians at large come in. You have a PhD, you're obviously brilliant, you're well-spoken, you're well-read, you've written prodigious works, but the average person in the pew, the average Christian, has to get involved. They need to always be ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within them, with gentleness and with respect. You think about the apostles. They stayed in Jerusalem. The believers went out into Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. They turned an empire right side up. And that's what has to happen in our epoch of time. Your comment.
Well, we have gotten the same advice from our advisory council. We are winning arguments by any reasonable measure, they say. But the challenge that we face now is that not many people know. And so it puts a great kind of imperative on us to begin to develop other kinds of materials to get the message out. And we're putting a great deal of stress on media and communications as we go forward, in addition to mainstreaming our research program. So we've got two M's right now, media and mainstreaming. And that's kind of where we are in the strategic development of this long-term project. And both of those things, unfortunately, cost a third M, which is more money. But, you know, we have lived to this point on what we call just-in-time financing. So we're hopeful. We've been working with a media company, which has some just terrific connections into Hollywood with some very good writers. There's a lot of stories to be told, and we'll be doing a lot more with media going forward. But that's a big place where we're putting effort, because we have textbooks. We have done a lot of wonderful videos, and you've highlighted them with Illustra Media. And we'll be doing more of that kind of straight science documentary work. But we want to be bringing things into theaters and textbooks, into a lot with YouTube video shorts and various types of media that can take advantage of the internet revolution. So that is the challenge. More people need to know. My colleague John Lennox in Oxford says that the new atheists are reaching millions while we're reaching thousands, and we want to reverse that curve. So that's where we go next.
Absolutely.
And we thank you for always giving us a platform to do that with your wonderful audience, because that has really helped. And we've had people come to us because they've heard your podcasts and broadcasts. So we are attracting a lot of young talent, and I think that is the most encouraging thing of all.
Well, it has been a blast having you on the podcast. I appreciate your work so much. We'll pray for you as you pray for us, and together we'll make a difference while there's yet time.
There we go. Absolutely. Thank you, Hank. And blessings on you, and thank you for the good work you've done for many, many decades now, not generations. Neither of us are that old.
So, I'm getting there.
Hang in there, man.
Well, hey, great talking to you.
Great
having you on the podcast. And by the way, for everybody listening in, many of you are giving us reviews, and I have been absolutely, well, humbled by the reviews. One homeschooler listening in Canada recently wrote, "This podcast is so very meaningful. Hank is quite gifted as a host and interviewer, but the length, the breadth, and the height of these discussions on the podcast go to exhilarating heights. Join the support team, people, pitch in, and help keep programming like this coming." And of course, the support team is very, very important, because we not only do a broadcast, we now do a podcast. We have a whole arsenal of digital media platforms, and we invite people to stand with us shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth. You can support the broadcast, the podcast, and the many 24/7 outreaches of the Christian Research Institute in a safe, secure fashion on the web at equip.org, or by simply writing me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And I think we're all grateful to Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's incredible, and his works are incredible. You can find them on the web at equip.org. Again, a quick review: Signature of the Cell, Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique, and Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life, and The Case for Intelligent Design. These are epic works. Again, available to those who support the ministry. Check it out on the web at equip.org. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Dr. Stephen Meyer in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. For details on how you can support the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute and receive your copy of Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, or Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design, call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. A major reason mindfulness has been successfully mainstreamed is that we are so overstimulated and chronically busy. Because mindfulness has entrenched itself in American culture, Christians need to investigate it thoroughly in order to determine whether it is friend or foe. Other topics include the Jesus of Mormonism, the philosophy of atheist Bertrand Russell, how does the human soul come into existence, the story of Morgan Freeman, not God, is it abusive to teach children about hell, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
From the outside, Houston preacher Joel Osteen is charming, attractive, and his teaching, well, it makes you feel good. But the truth is, Osteen preaches a seductive and highly dangerous form of Christianity that's leading millions of people astray. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity, and it's why you must get your own copy today. You must be able to defend yourself with truth about what Joel Osteen really teaches. and this important resource arms you with everything you need to do so. Please call today and request your copy of The Osteenification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.